In reality television, the people are represented by two separate but equally obsessed attorneys. This is their podcast.
Hi, I'm Ceci.
And I'm Angela.
And this is the Bravo Docket.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Guys, the time has finally come to watch Vanderpump Villa, and Angela and I have been so excited to watch it since we heard that they were casting people to go to her villa and experience this luxury vacation. It's going to be good.
For those who don't know, Vanderpump Villa is Lisa Vanderpump hosting luxury travelers at her villa called Chateau Rosabelle in the French countryside. So we're going to get the drama from people going and staying at her chateau. And we're going to get the drama from the staff behind the scenes, and you know it's going to be good. They're going to be living together, working together, playing together 24/7.
We know our Bravo Docket listeners are going to love this because we know that you all like the finer things in life because you're listening to our podcast. So this is perfect for all of you listening because Lisa's staff is going to try and provide once-in-a-lifetime experiences for the guests staying at Lisa's chateau, all the while trying to meet Lisa Vanderpump's high standards. And you all know Lisa Vanderpump has high standards. That is a high bar.
Watch new episodes of Vanderpump Villa every Monday, now on Hulu.
In reality television, the people are represented by two separate but equally obsessed attorneys. This is their podcast.
Hi, I'm Ceci.
And I'm Angela.
And this is the Bravo Docket.
All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Bravo Docket. So today we're going to be talking about some of the recent motions that have been filed in Jen Shah's case. I believe all of these were in anticipation of her trial when it was scheduled for March 22nd. But since it got moved, they're going to have a bit of time to argue these and resolve them. But they are very interesting. They're pretty juicy. Do you want to give us a little preview of what they are, Angela?
Yeah, so the motions eliminates the stuff that government wants in, Jen Shah wants out. Brian Moylan's book about the Real Housewives is cited multiple times. There's claims that Jen Shah threatened Stuart Smith, Stu Chains, and his wife, and they want to keep that out. Lots of really interesting stuff.
So do you want to give an overview of the motions in limine and what they are?
Yeah. So these are motions. When you have a jury trial, you file motions in limine. And that's when both sides say what they want to keep from being put in front of the jury so that the jury isn't prejudiced. There isn't a mistrial, things like that, because you can't unring a bell. You can't unhear or unsee things. And so they make arguments saying, OK, well, the relevance of this is so low, but the prejudice is so high that it shouldn't be admitted, even if it is slightly relevant, and so on and so forth.
So, yeah, the law around this is that evidence can be excluded or may be excluded if its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, confusion of the issues, misleading the jury, or by considerations of undue delay, waste of time, or needless presentation of cumulative evidence. So the moving party puts in what evidence they think should be excluded and why it would prejudice their case and sway a jury unfairly.
So I like to think of it like the scales of justice. And so you have to put the proposed evidence on one side and how much that actually tends to prove what the government wants to use it to prove, and then the potential prejudice to the jury on the other side. And if the prejudice of whatever the evidence is far outweighs the probative value, then it should be excluded on that basis. And so the judge has to look at that, put it in the scales and see, make a determination.
And then something that's going to be argued in these is that unfair prejudice in the criminal context can be evidence that shows someone's propensity or likelihood to commit crimes, and that evidence's probative value is outweighed by its prejudicial impact. And I think that's what comes up a lot in Jen Shaw's motions here. So it's like their capacity to do something, like that, the fact that they've lied before, they're going to lie again, things like that. Like that evidence is often withheld from the jury, unless it's in specific circumstances.
Like going through these, Jen Shaw is arguing that the government should not be able to put on evidence in front of the jury that she did not disclose to the IRS certain income from her participation in the crimes charged. So that's one thing the government wants to do. Number two, the government wants to admit evidence that Jen Shaw failed to maintain records relating to foreign financial accounts. And they're arguing that, no, this isn't direct evidence and it shouldn't be allowed in. So that's the second thing. Three, evidence. The government wants to get in evidence that in June 2018, that Jen Shaw directed Stuart Smith to lie during a Federal Trade Commission deposition. So that's the FTC deposition that Stuart Smith admitted to giving false testimony in his plea. And then four, the government wants to get in evidence relating to the use of a credit card of Mastery Pro Group by Jen Shaw. And she does not want that in. And then five, evidence that during the period of the indictment, which is a long time, that's like 9 years.
I think it was 12 years.
Yeah. So evidence that during those 12 years that Jen Shaw threatened Stuart Smith and Stuart Smith's wife. And Jen Shaw does not want that in front of the jury.
Or is the indictment period from when they received the indictment until now? Read it like that she may have threatened them after the indictment, but I don't know.
Well, in the motion, I don't know, because I that's what I thought initially, too.
Yeah.
But then in her attorney's motion that was filed on her behalf, they say the government will seek to admit evidence that during the time of the indictment, which spans 9 years, the defendant threatened Smith and Smith's wife. So, but I agree with you. I just assumed immediately that it was
she got arrested and then was like threatening.
Don't you know, snitches get stitches, don't you dare.
Like, right.
I'll drown you in a lake or whatever, like what she said to Whitney. And then finally, they do not want in any clips from the Real Housewives of Salt Lake City. They don't want any clips used from that in their case.
There's one more.
Oh, there's one more. Oh, okay. Oh, and then this is a big deal. Jen is arguing that the government should be precluded from introducing statements of alleged co-conspirators until the government establishes the scope of a single conspiracy. So we can talk more about that later. That's a big one.
So going back to the top, the exclusion of evidence of alleged tax evasion.
I mean, I can see their arguments on this one. This isn't direct evidence of the crimes that are being charged. So, I mean, it's not direct evidence of the conspiracy to commit money laundering. It's not direct evidence of the wire fraud via telemarketing. But I can see why saying being like, okay, well, if you believe that this was all, you know, completely above board and you weren't doing anything wrong, why didn't you disclose all of it on your federal tax returns? I mean, it looks bad, but it's also risky because it's like, she's like, who are they going to get this evidence? How are they going to get this evidence out? I mean, I guess they can't cross-examine her with it unless she takes the stand. So are they just admitting the records? I guess maybe they have a records custodian or somebody say like, these are the verified records, and they can ask that person on those records, was this income disclosed? No. So, you know, can you explain what that means? And maybe they have an expert or something for that. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, I have no idea. But I took their argument to be that the government can't just bring it in just because they want to bring it in. They have to tie it to the alleged fraud or directly link it to the direct alleged fraud. So
that's exactly right. It has to be probative of a disputed issue at trial. It can't be so ancillary. Then it doesn't, you know, meet that balancing test. And then the evidence that she failed to maintain records relating to foreign financial accounts. Again, I can see when you are charged with money laundering, how this could be an issue. So again, I get their point. They need to prove the connection specifically. So
yeah, because they allege that she has bank accounts in other countries. Like,
yeah.
What was it?
Kosovo.
Oh, Kosovo. I was going to say something else with the K. Yeah, in Kosovo. So they're like, why don't you have records of this? But why would she?
Isn't that the whole point?
Yeah.
So I mean, and they're saying the government has to show that this, the funds that in these foreign accounts are directly related to the alleged activity, and that the government shouldn't be able to put on this evidence until they can show that connection. And that's fair. I think that's fair. They should have to show the connection before they do that.
Isn't it interesting that they are not denying the existence of the accounts?
Well, so like reading this, I at the very beginning in their preliminary statement, they say the government's theory of the case is that Jennifer Shaw was involved in a conspiracy to commit wire fraud through a telemarketing scheme that spanned 9 years from 2012 until at least March 2021 and conspired to commit money laundering with the proceeds of the fraud. Ms. Shaw's defense is that while she worked in the telemarketing industry and worked with many of the people who are witnesses in this case, including Stuart Smith, she did not participate in the fraud. So because so many everybody else, as Ceci has explained and we've talked about in our episode, everyone else has pled guilty or offered a plea, they can't really deny. What, how many people is that again that have said, yes, this was fraudulent?
12.
Yeah. So that's 12 people saying, yeah, it was fraud. I did the fraud. I feel terrible about it. It's fraud. So they kind of like saying it wasn't fraud isn't going to work. They're essentially saying, okay, yeah, there was fraud, but she didn't know about it and she didn't participate in the conspiracy. So she thought everything was great and was reasonable and
but
above
she had
the law.
This account in Kosovo, just for fun.
Yeah.
So the third one is evidence that they want to exclude evidence that she directed Stu to lie during the FTC deposition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're basically saying like, it doesn't show anything that the government has to prove in this case, which.
Yeah. They argue, and this is the propensity part that I was bringing up before. They argue that this evidence would only be used to show her propensity for dishonesty, and on that basis, it should be excluded. So the only they're arguing that the government only wants to put this in to be like, look at how bad Jen is, instead of actually tying it to any part of the scheme. And on that basis, it's more prejudicial than probative. So it should be excluded.
The next thing, it's like the government wants to get on evidence relating to the use of the credit card by Mastery Pro Group by the defendant. The government proposes to elicit evidence that during the period of the indictment, the defendant used the credit card of Mastery Pro Group for personal expenses in violation of her agreement with Stuart Smith and falsely claimed that the personal expenses she charged to that credit card were unauthorized purchases made by her assistant in New York City. So her attorneys are saying, like, what is the justification for this? How does this prove anything specifically that is in the indictment? And it just, she's like, the evidence will only paint the defendant in a bad light as someone who would use a business credit card for personal expenses and then falsely blame another for its use. Are they admitting there that she did?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
They're not like, it should be excluded because it's false. They're like, it should be excluded because it paints her in a bad light, which I think you're allowed to paint people in a bad light in trial. Not everything has to be great, but it does have to meet a standard.
I mean, it does, like, you...
It has to be a reason you're bringing it in. Yeah.
The probative value has to outweigh the prejudicial... And, like, it can't... It should be as fair as possible to the criminal defendant, to the person charged with the crime. And it's kind of like, okay, so if the government has millions of documents and all this evidence and maybe 8 or 5 or 4 of the co-conspirators are going to say, oh, yeah, she did do this. She knew. Then why they don't need this extra stuff. And so there isn't a strong justification for letting it in. Also, like you have actually done all these things. You don't want her to get an appeal granted on the basis that this was an unfair trial either. So that's another consideration.
Yeah. This evidence is kind of like if they brought in the Uber driver.
Yeah.
To testify.
I mean, it's like some of it's like, I don't see if the government really has all this evidence, then they probably don't need all of this stuff. And it could very easily be very prejudicial.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the next one, evidence that she threatens Stu Chains and his wife. Now, that might, if Stu testifies against her, I could see how that could come in.
Yeah.
Because that shows that she knew that what they were doing was illegal and she was worried about, you know, I could see that coming in. But like the defense says here, without more details, difficult to discuss this proffer of evidence since neither the subject matter, content, or the timing is provided.
Yeah, they're like, it's not enough details for us to argue against why it shouldn't be brought in.
And then here I thought was real juicy stuff. Ceci, do you want to talk about this one a bit?
This is excluding any Real Housewives clips from use at trial. And we kind of knew they were going to do this. And it kind of came up in the voir dire questions too, where one of their proposed voir dire questions to the jury for jury selection is, have you ever seen Real Housewives of Salt Lake City? And do you think they're actually rich? And do you think you believe everything that on that show is actually true? So it's like they're painting this narrative that what you see on the screen isn't necessarily true. And it's kind of played up for the cameras and, you know, which it is.
Yeah. Just to read from some of the briefing, the defense opposes the use in evidence of any clips from Real Housewives of Salt Lake City. And they talk about how it would have to fall under one of the hearsay exceptions, which is true because it's an out-of-court statement. So to evaluate whether any of the statements the government might seek to use falls under an exception to the hearsay rule, it is necessary to examine the method used to produce and edit the housewife show, and also the motivations and contrivances that permeate the production of the Housewives franchise. As will be clearly shown below, there is no circumstance under which a clip of Jen Shah from her appearance on The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City should be used in court, as these clips do not have any indica of reliability, which is the fundamental principle underlying the hearsay exception, and indeed, the rules of evidence. And then I thought this was fascinating. So because this attorney is having to educate this federal judge on The Real Housewives and how they work. I mean, unless this federal judge, is it a man or it's a man, isn't it? Yeah. So unless this male federal judge is a fan of Real Housewives and has some familiarity with this, or his wife does, or I don't know, husband, whoever, then she has to educate the judge on it. So she has links to articles like See Real Housewives, A Beginner's Guide, Time.com. She says each Housewife series takes place in a different location, talks about New York City, Atlanta, and there's literally hundreds of episodes. So, and then she quotes Brian Moylan's book, The Housewives, which is, I bet when he wrote that book, he'd never had any idea that it would be quoted in legal proceedings for a Real Housewife who might go to jail for a long, long time. As Moylan stated, we know that many of these women are playing at being rich. One has to appear to have money to get on the show to make even more money, and then needs to be used to look like one has money. The persona of the women on each of the franchises is that they are glamorous, incredibly rich, live lives of extreme and conspicuous consumption, and are willing to reveal their private lives in public. There has to be a storyline and a narrative to create drama and maintain the interest of the viewers. Thus, the question arises, how fake or how real are the women and the lives portrayed on The Housewives? The answer is, the women in their lives are both real and fake, and it's impossible to tell where reality ends and fantasy and outright deception and fakery begins. The women, the housewives themselves, are real people. The basic facts of their lives are real. Their names, their husbands, the divorces, the time in rehabs, their children. But the more pertinent questions, according to Moylan, are how produced are these shows? How much of what you're seeing on TV is natural and spontaneous, and how much is crafted and manipulated? As Moylan puts it, when lives get turned into storylines, how much of it is reality? How much is for the camera, and how much is manipulated in the post-production? So the answer is a great deal, probably much more than the average viewer imagines. The line between what is real and what is produced, manipulated, and made up is porous and hidden. I love that this is in a legal briefing.
I know. It's so good.
Do you want to take the rest of it?
Yeah, let me scroll down. I just wanted to note that they're bringing this up because they're trying to say that there is an incentive to exaggerate the things that you put on the show, because as you get more popular, you make more money on the show and you want to stay on it to make more money. So people play up what they do on the show to stay on. And I think that's true. I think that's a really fair argument.
Yeah. Again, the government shouldn't have any problem if they have everything that they say they have, proving that Jen did these things without use of the Real Housewives footage. The stuff that I think might come in is where she talks about how Stuart Smith is her closest like goes on and on about that. And then the stuff where she says, you know, you've been with me every step of the way and all of that. Because if she's, as her defense, disclaiming knowledge of Smith or what he did or disclaiming their relationship or denying that, then that could come in like video recording of her saying that they are super close and do everything together and know he knows everything about her business. That could come in. I could see that part coming in. Honestly, I hope a lot of it comes in for the jury, but not necessarily for, I don't know if that's the best for like avoiding error on appeal. But
It will be interesting to see, yeah, what comes in. Wait, can you bring up the point? You haven't brought it up on our podcast. You brought it up when we did Meet Amy Phillips.
Oh, yeah.
The
yeah.
Bethany thing. Can you bring that up here?
Yeah. So a long time ago, before Ceci and I even connected on the internet, I had been kind of interested in Bethany's divorce, and I was reading some stuff about it. And it was fascinating because Bethany is so smart, and Bethany actually argued in her divorce proceedings. So Jason Hoppe, her ex, was trying to argue that he should get copies and, or, you know, of all of the recordings of Bethany for use in the divorce proceedings, and was trying to subpoena, I believe he was trying to subpoena all of that and to use part of it. And then Bethany argued very eloquently, I mean, better than I think an attorney could have argued that, that didn't have the knowledge that she had, that that should not come in, because for the court to, you know, order the production of that, and then for them to be able to use it, then the court would have to watch everything, would have to watch hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of video, because she said there's, you know, we record for 40 hours and then it's, there's a 10 minute clip that's taken out of that. And so for the court to understand the context of what was being said and what was being done, the court would have to watch all of it. And so Bethany was smart enough to make that argument to the court in a way that would be compelling to the court, because that judge does not have time and does not want to do that. And that's true. In order to get the true context of it, you would have to watch all of it. And so I just thought that was fascinating that she was able to argue that well, and also able to argue from the viewpoint of understanding what would be compelling to the judge, because that's, you know, difficult. That's difficult to do sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
They won that motion.
Yeah. And I think that is another argument that they're making here as well. So the first, like we just read through, is that they're playing it up for the camera to stay on the show. And then the second part is that it's highly edited and crafted through post-production. So it says that they film more than 40 hours of footage in a 44-minute episode, according to Brian Moyen. Is it Moyen or Moylan? Oh, they misspelled it there. Haha, that's their fault. Moylan, not me. I caught a typo. Moylan. And any actual clip of the Housewives is just a tiny portion of the footage that was shot. And an episode can turn a week of filming to just part of a day.
Yeah. And one thing I wanted to bring up, because I think this is, I never expected to read shade at Melissa Gorga in a legal pleading, but it says, at the beginning of every season of every Housewives production, the producers interview each character and work up a storyline for the season. Some of them are more or less real. A child going to college, comma. Some are entirely made up, trying to have another baby or pretending to want to open a particular business. And I'm like, is that directed directly at Melissa Gorga?
I thought that trying to have another baby was directed at Jenny.
Oh, no, I read that as Melissa Gorga had this storyline of how she supposedly wanted to have another baby and nobody believed it. And it came up at the reunion that she was faking that for a storyline.
Yeah.
That's
but
what
then they cite to Moylan. So,
yeah,
it's what. Yeah. Whatever he was thinking for that.
Yeah. So I don't know. But yeah, I think, yeah, trying to have another baby's maybe been a fake storyline from multiple people.
I think it started or the fake pregnancy, Ramona being like, I think God. I'm pregnant.
I was watching old episodes of Roni like a couple weeks ago and was just cracking up at that. And like,
that was so funny.
She's like on the yacht or whatever, being like, oh, I think, yeah. I was like, that is just no one.
I'm going to take
no.
a pregnancy test. It's like, okay.
If you're not, like, if you're that age and you're not getting your period, it's probably more likely menopause as opposed to you're knocked about. Okay. Okay, Ramona.
Yeah, so I think that's the crux of their argument.
Yeah, for that. So that, and but yeah, we'll see what comes in.
Oh, wait, let's read this. So she says, thus, while some of what goes on in any particular Housewives episode has some aspect of reality in that Miss Shaw is playing a character called Jen Shaw and not a totally fictional character who never existed, she is nonetheless playing a character who is molded by the requirements of being on the Royal Housewives of Salt Lake City, and any statements made in the context of playing that character on a show that has been highly curated and edited to satisfy its dramatic requirements do not have the indicia of reliability that would allow admission into a trial under the hearsay rule or any rules of evidence, nor should these clips be used for cross-examination as prior inconsistent statements for the same reason. Did you read that already?
No. No, but okay. I didn't read that already. No, and I think that's, yeah, I think what they're saying there is totally fair. And they also bring up, there are other techniques used by housewife editors like Frankenbites, you know, defined by Moylan as the gruesome name given to a process where an editor splices words someone has said from different sources to make a sentence the person didn't say at all. I think that's fair to bring that up because that does happen. And then the fact that they record confessionals after like a storyline has been established, so they know what they want them to talk about. And so it's just, you know, this is all the crafting of a narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But I think it'll be interesting to see what the judge rules.
They're going to have to pick out the specific clips, show them, I would assume, show them to the other side, and then they can argue the evidentiary objections over it. All bets might be off if she takes the stand and then it's impeachment. I don't know, but
yeah.
Be really interesting.
The last one?
So, yeah. This is the one where she wants to exclude. She says the government should be precluded from introducing statements of alleged co-conspirators until the government establishes the scope of a single conspiracy. And again, the conspiracies, it has to show like all these people were a group that had a goal that they all agreed upon. And so this is what they were all doing. This is all part of the same thing. It's like if you have a mob boss and then they've got captains and then they've got soldiers. If anybody's watched The Sopranos, that's and they're all agreeing. Yeah, this is how we're going to, you know, do whatever, like launder this money, do whatever. That's a conspiracy. So they're saying like you need to show the scope of a single conspiracy. There's so many actors and things going on here that in order to introduce evidence of co-conspirators, you have to lay the foundation that they were part of a conspiracy that Jen was actually a part of. So this is specific to Federal Rule of Evidence 801D2E, which says to admit hearsay testimony under Rule 801D2E, the district court must find A, that there was a conspiracy, and B, that the members included the declarant and the party against whom the statement is offered, and that the statement was made during the course of and in furtherance of the conspiracy. So these are the preliminary questions that have to be resolved by the district court. That's what they're arguing.
Okay, so Jen Shaw on the co-conspirator point, I just wanted to read a paragraph directly from the motion that I thought was really interesting. It gives us some insight into what she's trying to argue here or what she might try and argue in defense of herself at trial. So she says, it is defendant's understanding, so Jen, that the government will use Stuart Smith as a cord by which to tie Ms. Shaw to Smith's own crime spree and a host of other conspiracies and actors with whom Ms. Shaw has no real connection. But the government's own evidence suggests that Mr. Smith's testimony could be a gateway for impermissible hearsay. For example, the government used cooperators to secretly record calls with Mr. Smith in an effort to gather evidence against Mr. Smith and Ms. Shaw. While talking openly with his partners in crime about his own illegal behavior, Mr. Smith specifically tells these individuals to keep Ms. Shaw in the dark about the content of their conversations. This is but one example of the distinct conspiracies with distinct castes of conspirators and should give the court pause before allowing the government to carte blanche offer hearsay testimony under the impermissibly broad umbrella of, quote, telemarketing fraud. I thought that was just really interesting because it's interesting to read that there were recordings of phone conversations. I think we knew about that before and we've mentioned it in prior episodes. But the fact that supposedly in one of these transcripts that Jen got, Stu was like, leave Jen out of this, don't bring her in. I thought that was interesting. Did you have any thoughts on that?
No, but it just is really interesting because it makes you wonder, was Stu trying to keep portions of the funds for himself? Or was there some kind of concerted effort between the two of them? Like, was she using money that, you know, she didn't want like her family or Coach Shaw to be implicated? Or, you know, did they both have an agreement not to talk about each other? Who knows? But it's interesting.
It's super interesting. It could also be, and we mentioned this in our latest Supreme Court Zoom. If you want to join us monthly, we have these Supreme Court Zooms on Patreon. We mentioned in the Supreme Court Zoom that this could just be one transcript and one instance of him just saying, leave Jen off of it. We don't know if this happened often, but it is very interesting.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
All right, you know what I don't miss at all? Period. Pain, the cravings, you know, just the moodiness. Trust me, I get that. And so I want to talk to you about a product called EstoControl. It's a formula developed by Happy Mammoth, which is a supplement company dedicated to making women's lives easier. EstoControl contains science-backed herbal extracts that help support hormonal health, especially in women who suffer from PMS. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DOCKIT at checkout. Happy Mammoth also has the Bloat Banisher, which I've been trying, and it helps just make my tummy feel a little bit better throughout the day, especially when I'm just having really bad snacks or I'm stressing out. It's nice to have something I can reach to that helps me out a little bit. But again, for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DOCKIT at checkout. That's D-O-C-K-E-T, DOCKIT at checkout. But because we're lawyers, we do want to remind you that these statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. But yeah, go check out Happy Mammoth. I've enjoyed it, and I'm sure you will too.
Yeah, so the government filed an opposition to Jen Shah's motions in limine, and they have some defenses of their intent to get in some co-conspirator statements.
Well, everything.
Well, they have everything. So yeah, we just talked about the co-conspirator statements. But yes, they have responses to just about everything, and the details are still somewhat vague because the government seems to be holding its cards close to their chest, which they're allowed to do, are interesting.
Yeah, so I think we should go through these in the order that we went through Jen's arguments. So I guess technically it's seven things, but like five main pieces of evidence and then the two high level concepts. So the first thing we had mentioned was Jen wants to exclude the government's evidence of alleged tax evasion. And earlier in this episode, we explained why she wants that out. Do you want to talk about why the government wants to bring it in?
Yeah. I mean, so they argue that Jen Shah's failure to report telemarketing income on her tax returns is particularly probative in this case because she has taken the position that her telemarketing income was legitimate. She says, for example, in her motion that while she worked in the telemarketing industry and worked for many of the people who are witnesses in this case, including Stu Chains, she did not participate in the fraud. And the government points out that it has the burden of proof. And so because they have such a high burden, this is particularly relevant. If she believed that it was absolutely legitimate income, why wouldn't you just put it on your tax return instead of a bank account in Kosovo, as they're alleging?
They make a good point.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the next one, which we talked about, was the evidence of failure to maintain foreign accounts. The government for this one argues, hey, we put it in the indictment. We said you had accounts in Kosovo. This is within the heart of what constitutes direct evidence of the charged conspiracies. And they're saying if you didn't disclose these accounts, the Kosovo accounts, to the IRS, then it's consistent with our theory that these accounts were used to launder the fraud proceeds and that the defendant, Jen, took steps to conceal that participation in the conspiracies and the proceeds of her crimes. So they're saying this just goes to prove that you were in this conspiracy. Of course, we want evidence of those foreign accounts, especially if you weren't including them in your tax returns or filing them in the report of foreign bank and financial accounts. They want to bring that in before the jury.
Yeah, and I think another good point the government makes is if you listen to some of our other episodes on this case, we talked about some of the other pretrial motions. And one of the big things that Jen Shaw was alleging via her counsel was that it's too vague. She doesn't understand exactly what the government is alleging that she's done wrong. And, you know, what accounts, because there is a separate there. It isn't just the wire fraud. There is the money laundering charge, as we explain on YouTube. But she says she doesn't know which ones. And they're saying, well, yeah, it's the ones in Kosovo. So you've had plenty of notice as to which bank accounts we're talking about were involved in the telemarketing scheme. So they make another point there.
It was in the indictment. We all read about Kosovo.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about the next one, the FTC lying?
Yeah. So, you know, part of our motion limine to exclude that was that the notice of what they want to get in is deficient with regard to this FTC deposition. And their response is basically that Jen Shaw has had plenty of notice to prepare for this evidence. They produced the FTC deposition in discovery, and that during the deposition, the FTC, which is the Federal Trade Commission lawyers, questioned Smith about his work in the telemarketing industry. And then they're saying, notably, at several points throughout the deposition, Stu Chains conspicuously did not mention the defendant when he was asked about individuals with whom he worked at various telemarketing companies. Also, just to point out, we went back and again, we talked about this in our last Supreme Court Zoom. We went back and looked at those FTC charges and they're almost identical. It's just a civil charge. It would seem it would put you on pretty high levels of notice as to the legitimacy of this type of alleged behavior.
Right. Yeah. And that's the government wants to bring this in because it's saying that she knew that she was engaging in fraud and took steps to actually hide her involvement from it. So they think it's weird that Smith wouldn't have mentioned working with her at this deposition, but he did mention that he worked with some of the defendants kind of in his plea. He didn't mention Jen by name, but it's just interesting because they actually did work together. And it goes to your earlier point, maybe they had some sort of agreement to leave each other's names off of calls or leave each other's names out of certain things to try and not implicate each other. But it is just weird that he wouldn't mention Jen if they were coworkers in this deposition.
Yeah. And Sessie's right. They're saying this is direct evidence of her intent. And if for this conspiracy to commit wire fraud telemarketing charge, they can't just show that she was involved. They have to actually show her state of mind. And if any of you have watched or listened to the Dropout about Elizabeth Holmes and, you know, that whole debacle, the government had to prove the same thing. They had to prove she had the intent to defraud investors and the intent to do those things. And so it's actually having to prove what's in someone's mind, which is difficult to do. They're saying this is some evidence of it.
All right. And then the next thing that Jen was trying to keep out is use of the Mastery Pro Group credit card. We talked about her arguments earlier. The government responds and says that evidence of the disposition of fraud proceeds is relevant to several important issues at trial, including participation in the fraud scheme, control over the scheme, and motive for engaging in the crime. The fact that she used the card in violation of her agreement with Stu and then lied about it may be further relevant to rebut any number of possible defenses, including lack of control, lack of intent to defraud, or mistake. What do you think about this one?
I mean, the just non-lawyer Real Housewives fan in me wants to know everything she bought with that credit card. I want to see what is on the Mastery Pro charge account.
Like that Girardi list.
So that's
remember when we got that Girardi list and posted it on our Instagram?
Yeah.
And like several followers were like, this charge is this person and this charge is this. That was fun. I want to see that too.
That was fun. So I thought that was interesting. And then the government makes a point that says they haven't decided whether or not to elicit this testimony if it comes in at trial. But they say it's not going to be more sensational or more disturbing than the charged crimes and will therefore not be unduly prejudicial. And they cite a case in support of that. I've never heard that argument before, basically saying if for it to be more prejudicial than probative, then it needs to be worse than the crime charge. But I don't know how good that is. I mean, think about like a murder case. There's so many small things that could be really prejudicial that aren't worse than murder. Right. So I don't know. I haven't researched that, so I can't speak to the veracity of that argument.
This one just feels like the weakest one to me. I don't know. Like the fact that she used the credit card and lied to Stu. Okay. So what?
It's almost like the 90s comics, like women be shopping. Like, what? Why is
yeah.
this?
Like, okay. They're not charging her for like not paying her credit card bills. It's just weird. But the next one that Jen was trying to keep out and the government responds to is evidence that during the indictment period, Jen threatened Stu and his wife.
Yeah. So, I mean, the indictment period, like we said earlier, is like 9 years. So that's a long time. I will say I thought Stu Chains looked, and this is not a lawyer response, this is just me watching the show, he did look scared of her.
I think a lot of people looked scared of her.
But I thought it was just more he was uncomfortable being on TV. But he looked nervous around her. But we've seen her like be very threatening. She threatened to drown. Didn't she threaten to drown Whitney in the lake? Let me switch back to legal topics. They're saying this evidence would be very probative because of their case, because they believe she is going to allege that Stu Chains was the mastermind behind any fraudulent activity and that she was kept in the dark about the criminal conduct, in which that does align with what she said that we saw the last season of Salt Lake City. She seemed to be very clear. I had no idea what was going on. These charges confused me. You know, Smith had his own stuff, and she acted shocked that she had gotten arrested and indicted. So
yeah,
I can see her making that argument.
I know. I think she is, and this is kind of proof that she is. We'll have to wait and see if she does at trial. But what do you think of the question that we got at our Zoom again? Our Zoom is so fun, that she, after being deposed, her and Stu and the FTC giving the sanctions against their old company, that they took that and started their new company thinking that they were doing it right this time. That they were like, we're going to do it right this time. We're not going to make anything illegal. We're going to like be by the book. What do you think about that argument? Do you believe that that is what Stu and Jen were trying to do? Do you think that's something that they're going to argue at trial? What do you think?
I mean, that might be something that it's hard because like that might be something that Jen tries to argue, but that she thought she was doing it correctly. But she seems to be disavowing that she was in business with Stu Chains, which I don't know how she's going to do that. Yeah. But there isn't, you still have to have a real product for this. You have to be selling a real product, like something that is just not just an utter fabrication, which is what the government is alleging. So I think that's an argument she will make. I don't know how like well it's going to work for her.
I mean, the Kosovo accounts and the Tiger text, I don't think helps that argument. The fact that she had foreign accounts and that she was allegedly trying to be sneaky about it. So I don't know. And you're right. That is a competing narrative. Like, how can you be doing it right with Stu, but then also not work with Stu? So we'll see what she tries to do. I think I am leaning more towards her maybe argument that they didn't work together at all. I think she'll do that.
Yeah. I like this. I mean, this sentence in here is interesting because it looks like one of the things that Stu and or the government are going to say is that, and this is a quote, evidence the defendant threatened Smith and his wife is relevant to the nature of the relationship, which is what Ceci and I were just talking about. But then they say it's also probative of her guilt by showing that Shaw exercised emotional and psychological control over Smith. So either she might try to make the argument that he was controlling her, but then it looks like the government could possibly be putting on Stu to make the argument that she had emotional and psychological control over him.
It just gets more and more interesting, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
Did they argue stuff about the Housewives clips?
Yeah, they did. They did say, they said the government will likely offer as trial exhibits brief clips. This is a quote from the reality television show, The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City. They say the clips will consist of defendants, meaning Shaw's, statements and interactions with other members of the telemarketing scheme, including Smith. So I'm like, wait a minute. Yeah.
Whoa.
Now, this is not, please nobody hear us say this and think that one of the other cast members is involved. That's Mm-mm. not what I think this Mm-mm. means. She's had multiple assistants that we've seen over the 2 years that Salt Lake City has aired. And so I think that's what that is. I don't want anyone to take this as like, you know, Baby Gorgeous was implicated in the telemarketing scheme or something.
Justin, Whitney's husband.
or Justin or anybody.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
And then on the co-conspirator statements, what did they argue there?
I mean, co-conspirator statements are just well known to be admissible. So they go ahead and make all the arguments for that. They say the government anticipates that cooperating witnesses will testify about conversations with individuals who worked with the defendant about the telemarketing scheme. And then they say these co-conspirator statements all fall within a tightly defined conspiracy of individuals who worked with the defendant either at companies she controlled or at companies with which she partnered. The government alleges that these co-conspirator statements are admissible under Federal Rule of Evidence 801D2E, and which says, you know, a statement is not hearsay if the statement is offered against an opposing party and was made by the party's co-conspirator during and in furtherance of the conspiracy. So that's what they're saying, like, this is the Federal Rule of Evidence. This is exactly what we're trying to do, is what the rule says we're allowed to do, and we'll get that in. So to admit a statement under this rule. So hearsay is an out-of-court statement for the truth of the matter asserted, which is basically saying it's like just a statement that you're trying to say the statement is true, whatever the content of the statement is, but it was made outside of court or some other admissible evidence. So to admit a statement under the co-conspirator rule, the court, and this is a legal issue, so the court has to find two facts, and they say by a preponderance of the evidence. One, that a conspiracy that included the defendant and the declarant existed, and two, that the statement was made during the course of and in furtherance of the conspiracy. So because her alleged co-conspirators have all pled guilty, then and acknowledged the existence of the conspiracy, the government kind of has that in the bag for getting evidence.
That's a shoo-in. Yeah. Yeah.
So they have the government has like a, this is obviously the co-conspirator statements are very important. So there's a lot more that they have in their response. They do point out that they'll prove the existence of a smaller conspiracy to launder the funds of the telemarketing scheme. Apparently somebody is going to, there's another co-conspirator that's going to testify about that as well. So yeah, that's the government's response.
All right. So we actually don't know what the outcome is on this. It's still being heard. But we will update everyone once we have a decision on all of these, because they're all very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So then there were some other filings filed by the co-defendants in Jen Shaw's case, and it was motions to quash the subpoenas that Jen Shaw served on the co-defendants' counsel. I believe she served these subpoenas on all of the co-defendants' counsel. And the government ends up joining in on these motions. Let me read what is going on. So the reason that they're trying to quash, which is like, I kind of feel like quash is one of those words that it kind of sounds like what it is.
What it does, because like, it sounds like squash.
Squash. Yeah. Yeah. It's like onomatopoeia. Is that what that is?
Yeah, I think so.
It's like, it's basically to squash it. Like, I'm not going to produce these things that you are asking me to produce. It's asking the judge to rule on that. And so the subpoena, they put what the requests are that Jen sent them. In the subpoena request, the production of the following documents. All documents and communications between you and any member of the United States Attorney's Office concerning this matter. Number two, all documents and communications between you and any law enforcement agent concerning this matter. And number three, all attorney notes or other documents prepared by you from each proffer session attended by the defendant in connection with this matter. So that was the only three requests served, but they were served on all co-defendants' counsel, I believe, and they're trying to knock it out.
Anything you want to say on that one?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's that may have been a good, like some of the stuff the government has to go ahead and give up. And so at some point before trial. And so having filing these motions, like in sending the, we're sending the subpoenas to the outside people could maybe hurry the government along with actually producing it. So that might have been a good strategy.
And I think you're right. I think that is their strategy because then the government joined in on the motions and said that the requests were improper, but anything she's not seeking that isn't privileged will be produced via the government's production. Mm-hmm. So they're like, don't go chasing the co-defendants. We're going to give you your stuff. Just wait.
Yeah. But the fact that like now there's pressure on getting it done, that could, yeah, like you said, that could be helpful.
All right. The next one is a motion to quash filed by ABC. And I wanted to talk about this one because who knew? Who knew that the documentary would be all over this docket? So really, it seemed to me that the subpoena, and we have the requests in here, in the motion to quash, it seems like she's really asking for the notes with the prosecutors that were interviewed as part of the mm-hmm. documentary, not necessarily the notes that we may have sent back and forth. So I think we're fine. Not that we sent anything outside of the docket. But so they say that Genshaw's subpoena seeks all footage, including raw video footage made or used in conjunction with the program. So the doc. All documents and communications between ABC News and any member of the prosecution team concerning the documentary, identification of all government agents or other members of the prosecution team who provided information to ABC News in connection with the program, any and all releases, waivers, or other documentation provided to any individual who appeared on the program, including any member of the prosecution team, all video footage concerning defendant Jen Shaw filmed in preparation for the program, any and all documents and communications concerning the interviews taken for the documentary, and communications between you and any employee of Forest Production, Intent TV, Bravo, or NBC Universal concerning the documentary. So they're just trying to get everything
yeah.
from the doc. And they are trying to squash the motion because based on the journalistic privilege, which I have never dealt with the journalistic privilege before. But I guess the crux of it is that there is some privilege when people speak to journalists. Anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, so I am so used to complex, high dollar, really contested civil litigation in federal court. And in those types of cases, the amount of stuff that you have to produce if it's asked for tends to be like really broad and astronomical. And so I feel like looking at this as a civil litigator, it's kind of like, this would be kind of basic third party discovery. Like you would ask for it. I'm not talking about the governmental privilege or the, you know, the reporting
journalistic
privilege. Yeah. But just being like, hey, if someone has talked about this or if it could potentially lead to relevant evidence and if it's, you know, proportional to the needs of whatever the case is in a civil case, you could make a really strong argument for getting it. But in a criminal trial where someone's life and freedom is at stake, it's like the amount of stuff that you're allowed to ask for seems to be so much narrower. Yes, the government has to provide you, you know, exculpatory information and has to provide you like by law things. But it just seems like you're allowed to ask for so much more in a civil trial. And then it tends to maybe even get granted more often. I just think the contrast is interesting.
Yeah, I agree. So the standard for proving privilege here, if it's a non-confidential source, I guess it's a little narrower to prove whether or not something's privileged. But the litigant, so that Jen, would be entitled to it if she can show that the material at issue are of likely relevance to a significant issue in the case and are not reasonably obtainable from other available sources. So if those notes, if the extra footage was relevant to something in the case, like an issue in the case, and she can't get it from somewhere else, then she should be able to get it.
I mean, I can see her asking for the people at like the Department of Homeland Security, even though they weren't directly involved with her case. I mean, I think the government was obviously very careful. They balanced the need, like their goal is to get this information out. And I think the documentary did a great job of showing how these scams can work and increasing awareness about them and, you know, encouraging people to report them and showing the harm that they can cause. And so hopefully preventing other people from joining similar scams and doing that type of telemarketing or whatever. I think that's really important. I think the government has a very strong interest and valid interest in doing that. And I think they were very careful not to do anything that would interfere or involve the actual investigation. So I don't think she has a good argument for this, but I understand why she's asking for it. I don't think that does she want the stuff Dana Wilkie said? Does she want Dana Wilkie's notes? That's not going to help. I can see why it's being asked for, but I don't think that she's going to get it. And I don't think she's entitled to it because I don't think there's a strong enough argument.
No. And there was a motion that she filed shortly after it came out seeking to dismiss the whole case because of those HSI agents' involvement in it. And the judge shut that down.
I just felt like she had no argument for that. She continued to appear on TV. We can't argue. That's not going to work. So in response to the government moving to quash the subpoena, she says that ABC News incorrectly claims that the information sought by the subpoena is categorically irrelevant. The information requested bears on the allegations of the underlying indictment. Specifically, the subpoena requests statements of potential trial witnesses in the case. To be clear, neither Ceci or I are potential trial witnesses in any way. We have no facts, no personal knowledge of anything, nothing. So we're not involved with that. I don't think Dana Wilkie is either. Ronald Richards definitely is not. Who else was on?
The random fan.
Yeah, the fan. I don't. He could. He could be. Yeah, the designer, the clothing designer, he could be. So she's saying specifically they request the statements of potential trial witnesses, including alleged victims, supervisor, agents. These are certainly relevant to, this is her statement, Ms. Shaw's case. And then she's saying the potential witnesses may have made statements to a third party that could be used as a prior inconsistent statement. So that's why there could be potentially exculpatory evidence. And she says the subpoena seeks actual prior videotaped statements from potential witnesses in Ms. Shaw's case and not just third party notes of those statements. She's making the arguments that if any of these people that were on the documentary are actual witnesses, I should get their statements. And I think Ceci's right that the only one I can think of would be Koa because he actually had personal knowledge of Jen and interactions with her.
Yeah, so we'll see. This one is also still pending. We don't have a decision yet. Relatively a new motion, so we'll see how it comes out. Anything else to add on these motions?
No, not on these.
Okay, so yeah, that was all of the motions that have been recently filed. I think these were obviously in anticipation of trial when it was set for March 22nd, but now that it was pushed to the summer, they're gonna have a bit to kind of resolve them. Anything else you want to add about these motions or Jen's case?
No, just
in general,
she is innocent until proven guilty. We haven't seen all the facts, and I am just really interested for who the witnesses are going to be and what is actually going to come in. I wouldn't be surprised if the judge grants some of the motions of keeping, because the judge just probably doesn't want to deal with the clips unless he absolutely has to. I wouldn't be surprised if some of her motions to exclude things do get granted.
Agreed. And then I wanted to raise how Heather said that she was going to be sitting there every day of the trial to support Jen, and same with Coach. So if we go, we'll see you there, guys.
I like New York in the summertime, so.
Which I still think it's going to get moved again, to be honest, but we'll see. You want to wrap us out?
Thanks, guys. Thanks so much for listening. As always, you know, check out our Instagram for updates in between episodes. If you want to vote on what our next episode is going to be, get on our Patreon. Like I always say, our merch is it's really cute. If you guys have things that you want, let us know. And yeah, thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.
The Bravo Docket is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
The Bravo Docket is part of the Acast Creator Network.